Today, I'm going to talk about how people learn, and kind of, to me, God is like the greatest psychologist, right? I read the scriptures in a way that it might be kind of backwards. I'm looking at how God interacts with people and his message. I'm trying to apply that with how I interact with people. Maybe I should look at it more introspectively, but... But I really kind of focus on that. And that's how I use in my practice, too. I'm not a Christian counselor. You know, that's not my background. But it's the same principles that God uses to just make better people, you know. So the learning process. So your brain and yourself are the same exact thing. There's actually, research that states that there's neurological cells in your stomach and in your heart. So when people say, oh, you got to think with your heart, that really is true. There is neurological cells in there. So how people learn is through their senses. Okay, we pick up new information through each one of our senses, and it goes into our brains. And every brain is different. You know, I'm 6'1", and I got like monkey arms, right? Not everybody's 6'1" and got monkey arms, and not everybody's brain is the same. And a lot of them are very, very different. We all produce different chemicals. We've all had different genetics. People are born with certain things. You know, my son, when he was born, he definitely knew how to cry, right? That was not a learned behavior by any means. He knew to cry when he's hungry. He knew some physiological stuff, like how he can move and things like that. But the rest of the things you learn are through experiences and through that stimulus. One example would be like if I, let's say I seen a doorknob, right? Well, that stimulus goes in, and all these different thoughts and synapses connect from all my experiences I've had with doorknobs, right? And most likely I'm going to open the door because I've done it 1,000 times. But let's say I've opened that door and something bad's happened, right? Like I got shot or something. I'm going to have a different reaction whenever I open a door again. And behavior and reactions are kind of, to me, like a big mathematical equation. You have all these different variables, like how you grew up, the weather, like thousands of variables, and you get this one response. And every response is different. You know, people categorize emotions as angry or sad. Well, I've never been angry the same way twice. I've never been sad the same way twice, right? Using those principles, that's kind of how I work in my practice. I'm the stimulus, right? I would be the doorknob. And I'm trying to change how people think or change a variable so they get a better response, whether that's emotion, whether that's a behavior, whatever. And it really applies to how we minister to other people. You know, the one thing I really want to stress today is when you minister, it is really, really about quality over quantity. You know, I think of one kid I've had, I've had him since first grade, and he's going into eighth grade next year. We've been in practice. I've had him since then. And he was sexually abused by his father. And I've seen him that long, and it's took me a good, 7 years to really have those deep, intricate conversations with him. I've seen him once a week for 7 years, and to be able to have these emotional conversations with just some random stranger is most likely never going to happen. To walk up to someone on the street and try to talk to them about their deepest, darkest secrets and how they should be changing is just not really realistic. So we learn through senses, and those past experiences really affect how a person reacts. So part of the Bible really is, geared towards immediate gratification versus delayed, right? In immediate gratification, you think, everybody thinks that's a bad thing, right? But God also uses it. It really is a way to get your foot in the door, if I have a kid that is, if he's not listening and he's not very developed morally, that's really how I get him to change as quickly as I can because of that immediate gratification. You know, we'll do behavioral charts, we'll do whatever to get those immediate results. And they're not sustainable by any means. You know, that's not going to last forever. But that is really how you get started. Now, delayed gratification plays a part too. You know, God's always mentioning how you'll feel better at the end of the day. You know, and being a Christian's hard. It's not this easy, you know, piece of cake thing. You have to make a lot of sacrifices. And you're trying to convince people of this. Like, hey, this is a better life. But you're not going to feel the greatest all the time, right? So because of that, you know, I was really this behavioralist early in my career. I focused so much on these consequences and rewards and things like that. And I'd get these kids out of counseling and out of services, and then 6 months later they'd come back, right? And it started making me realize, hey, this isn't really sustainable for them. So I came up with a different model for these kids, and it's really it's empathy-based motivation. If you make a decision based off how it affects other people, you always make the right decision. It's never every societal rule is based off how it affects everyone else. You know, let's say if I get on the interstate today, I have to drive to Fort Chisholm after this. Well, I know where every cop sits from here to Fort Chisholm. I could speed the entire way, right? But if I look at it in a way that, hey, I don't want to speed because I might hurt someone, then I'm never going to speed, right? And I really need to use that model with my wife, but that's kind of what I want kids to really understand, and adults, that if you make these decisions on how it affects other people, you don't come back to counseling. You know, you're never coming back. And you're fulfilled emotionally, too. You know, you have more purpose. You have more drive. You know, there's kids that are in services from the time they're 3 years old to the time they're 70 years old, you know. I think of one kid, I mean, he's 18 now, and he's probably used like $10 million in taxpayer money just in mental health services. You know, and if he can't understand these empathy-based models, he'll be in services till he passes away. So today, the next point I want to make is about how people change, right? There's a model in how people change, and there's different steps. Let's see. So there are 5 stages of change in psychology, all right? The first one is pre-contemplation, and what that really means is you don't know you have a problem, right? That's very rare, okay? Very, very rare. And knowledge is usually not the issue when you're trying to help people change. You know, people know whether they're doing right or not. You know, there's numerous studies that say 2-year-olds know morality. You know, they know the difference between right and wrong. It's more of willing the self to change. That's, to me, usually the right decision is very obvious. It's not this, you know, big complicated ordeal. It's I have to will myself to make the right decision. So contemplation is that point where you're trying to figure out whether you should change or not, right? You're trying to figure out, oh, is this really the right decision? Is this the wrong decision? And then the preparation is when you're about to change, right? You're making the right steps to get ready for that action of change, which is the next one, is during your actual change. And really, the actual change is the shortest step here, you know. The actual decision is very, it doesn't take half a second, you know. And then maintenance, you know, and that's more of, is it going to be sustainable? Are you going to be able to continue with that? So this is one passage. You know, the next thing I want to get into is how to build rapport with these people so that you can learn how to get into these conversations about change. And this passage of scripture is really, really focused on humility. You know, it's not a... I see every single day, you know, I work with a bunch of mental health workers, and I see every single day humility comes in between them and a client. You know, I might have been, like, have all these credentials after my name and have done this great stuff, but it makes me no better than the person I'm working with. Absolutely not. And especially in God's eyes, you know. Your societal status means nothing. You know, I'm not any better than the person who can't afford their electric bill or is addicted to meth or any of that stuff. I'm never any better. And that's pretty much what God talks about in a lot of instances, you know, that you really have to humble yourself to ever communicate with anybody. Even like a 4 or 5 year old, you know, a lot of people think, oh, I'm an adult, so I know more, so that I know what I'm doing more. I think I know what I should say. I've been touched by 5-year-olds a lot better than any adult usually. They say some of the best stuff and make me change even better, you know. So let's see. So when we talk to someone, you know, you can think back. Let's say if you've been in court or something and you have to go in front of a judge. You're really humble then, right? You're talking up that judge, you know. Or let's say you're like talking to a cute girl or guy, right? You know, you're really talking them up. You're humble. And that's really how we want to focus on these other people that you want to minister to. You know, I'm showing them that I am no better than them, and really that I'm interested in them. Like, that, you know, I cherish my relationships with clients way more than I cherish my relationships with a psychiatrist or something, right? Or a doctor. That's way more important to me. And that, you know, I would fight tooth and nail with a psychiatrist as long as I can remain rapport with a kid that we're working with, you know? When you're trying to talk and show interest with someone, you almost have to do a little research, right? When I work with 3-year-olds, man, I can name like every My Little Pony there ever was, okay? And I can talk Pokemon with anybody, you know. In fact, our next kid will probably be named Charizard. So.
Your wife has something to say about that.
So, you know. To talk to someone, you know, you might have to do some research about what they like. You know, that shows credibility that, hey, I'm interested in you and I care about you and your interests. And really, you can kind of make it seem like you're interested in you if you're not. You know, I can talk Star Wars. I don't even watch Star Wars. I never thought in a million years that I would know every My Little Pony. And part of that was because I was competitive, because we had this match game and I kept losing because I couldn't tell the difference between My Little Ponies. So I got really into it, so I'd stop losing. But so when we build this rapport, you know, 90% of your communication is nonverbal. How your position is, your posture, the way you look at them, even the room setting is really more dependent than your actual verbal skills. In my office, I have a really nondescript office, and it's really messy usually. When I'm really getting into a deep conversation with a kid, I never have them sit directly across from me. Okay, it never works that way. They feel like they're getting interrogated. You want to take every social anxiety that kid might have with eye contact or how they should be sitting or whatever. You want to eliminate that as much as possible so that they're living in the moment for the topic that you're discussing. Okay, I usually have them sit directly beside me and we're looking at something else because that really takes the awkwardness out of it. You know, I have the deepest conversations playing Mario Kart painting or something. You know, I tell parents that you really want to have an intricate conversation with a kid, try it in the car. You know, that's, if you just set them down and interrogate them, it's not going to work. They're just going to think they're in trouble or you know, be scared. So, you know, the next point is understanding when it is the right moment to discuss change. In therapy, I see people for an hour at a time. And if you talk an hour over these emotionally deep conversations, it's too much. Okay, if you do 15 minutes, it's absolutely exhausting for you and the person. It's unsustainable, and you really don't, the person probably won't come back if you try to do this for an hour, you know, because they're not having a good experience. They're going to leave, and it's going to take them 3 days to recover, you know. And especially a kid, you know, if you can get a kid to have a 5-minute serious conversation, you're doing pretty good. So don't feel like you have to have this long, drawn-out discussion. You know, if you can get 15 or 20 minutes, you're doing really well with an adult. And so to recognize when people are ready to talk about change, that's another situation that's very hard to pick up on, you know, and a lot of that is still nonverbal. They're leaning forward, that might be a cue, right? And a lot of it's like trial and error, and you might try to dwell into that conversation, and that you'll know whether it's time or not, you know? Sometimes people just want to spill their guts out, you know? And then sometimes people just want to, like, shoot the breeze, you know? That's probably the most crucial thing when you're trying to figure out whether you should talk about it or not. You know, I went to this training and this guy, he was really into like this thing called heart field, right? And he says there's like a moment in time where you're a little bit more vulnerable and open to change, you know, and you get into this, you know, it's almost like an emotion or feeling that you have. And it's really trying to identify that. And a lot of it's instinctual, and I'm sure a lot of you guys already do tons of this stuff. Sometimes you do it without even noticing. But it's really kind of with a kid, they're sometimes they're easier to read, sometimes they're harder to read. Usually when they come to see me, they're looking for help, right? So it's a little bit easier on me than if I walked up to a stranger and tried to build a relationship with them. You know, I mean, if you're already coming to see me, then either you think you need a change, or your parent or your probation officer thinks you need a change, right? So, you know, it's, you know, when we apply it to ministry, it's an awkward situation. You know, you might have 0.001% of your conversations really dwell into this emotional stuff. And then the rest of the 99% is shooting a breeze or, you know, doing something else. One thing that I really want to stress is I never tell anyone what to do. Absolutely not. It doesn't not matter one bit if I know what to do. It matters if they figure it out. And if I come across by saying, you need to do this, 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 and this, well, they're probably going to be resistant. Okay? They're not going to... Now, it's different if you have someone in church and they're looking for something, right? Because I'm not as knowledgeable as I should be with the Bible, but there are plenty of people here that are. If you're looking for something, they're going to tell you exactly what the Scripture says and what God says to do, right? But in a different setting, you know, you come across as like holier than thou, I guess, right? Man, what's this guy thinking that he knows more about something and telling me how I should live my life, right? Nobody changes to that. And if they do, it's still unsustainable. You know, they have to self-realize. So, you know, that goes back, you're really just a guide. You know, you're not this, like, end-all, be-all, I'm going to change this person. If they get better, it's because of them. I could be the greatest therapist on earth, and if someone gets better, it's still because of them. You know, I tell all my clients, you know, I could be Dr. Phil, and you still might not get better, right? You're really just trying to focus on, you know, asking the right questions and making the right comments so that they self-realize. And really, it's hard to do. You know, a lot of people are already doing whatever is best for them. That's a natural human instinct. You don't have to tell them, you know, you should be doing this and this and this because it's going to benefit you more. They're already doing that naturally. It's not, you know, and you think, man, what about these people that are like doing all this bad stuff? Well, they have more importance to whatever gratification they're getting than you would. So they're already doing the stuff that makes them happy and immediately gratified. Nobody's just going to be purposefully depressed or purposefully trying to get angry. That's not how life works. So go into a conversation and be like, you're going to end up with this and you're going to have this great life and do all this stuff. They're not going to change to that. It's just not going to happen. They're already trying to do whatever is best for their life and for their family. You know, a kid that stays in trouble all the time, I could talk to him blue in the face about, oh man, being in trouble makes your life worse and stuff like that. Well, they're getting more out of whatever they're doing than any consequence they're getting. So why would they change? It's pointless. So really this today is really about people locally. You know, if you're going on a mission trip or something, it's a whole different idea. But really the people around here have heard all this gospel stuff all their entire life. It's not a knowledge issue. It's not this epiphany is going to happen. It's not the issue. I think there's like 68 churches in Smith County or something, right? So I guarantee you, you're going to be not the first person to try to witness to them. And they have all these past experiences of people witnessing to them. And that means that they're going to have a preconceived notion about what you are and what you do, right? So that's really where that building that relationship is important. You know, you don't just go into, hey, I want you to change, I'm a follower of Christ and all this stuff. It's not going to work, at least around here. It's definitely not. They might think that, you know, and really how you dress and everything is going to play into that. You know, you think of my best friend lives in California, and he spent 2 years as a Mormon doing his missionary work. And you guys all know what they dress like, right? Yep. And when they knock on your door, you've already had experiences with them, and you already have preconceived notions about what they are, right? So how you dress and how you walk and all these things are going to play in a part on whether they're going to be willing to change or not. Like I wear funky socks all the time. They rarely match, right? I got like flower shoes on today. And you might think, man, that, you know, he's just kind of weird. And maybe that is true, but it is with a purpose too. You know, I found early in my career I would try to dress up and like do all these things, and it was almost intimidating, you know. I really try to dress down and be as professional as I can while doing that, you know. Because I have to interact with, you know, I don't want to look like a principal by any means, because that's really almost my setting, my office. I have a desk, and you're sitting across from me, you know. I wish I could just wear something else, but... So really take notice of that. If you're really trying to build a relationship with someone, you know, be conscientious of how you look. What kind of, you know, even if you shaved or not, it's a big deal. No joke. During deer season, I like, you know, try to grow this scraggly beard that my wife hates. That's going to play a part in it. You know, I can't tell you how many kids make comments about stuff like that. And really, when you're in this conversation, that person is telling you what they want by how they interact. Me and Chad turkey hunt a lot, right? And whenever I'm calling a turkey, that turkey is telling me exactly what he wants by how he's acting, right? If he's all fired up, I'm going to call him a bunch, right? If he's just gobbling a little bit, you know, I'll stand up and walk away and act like I'm not as interested. That's kind of how you're trying to figure out people. Is they're going to sit down and really tell you exactly what they want. You know, I work with some borderline personality disorders, right? And a borderline personality disorder is probably the most debilitating disorder there is. And really, they're self-centered. They have no empathy. They have all this stuff, right? We can build rapport with them easy. All you gotta do is talk about what they like, right? They'll think you're their best friend. And then there's some people that, you know, I have some kids that have like a codependency thing where they only want to talk about you, and they live vicariously through other people. So you really have to understand how these people are interacting and how they're trying to tell you what you need to tell them. And that really goes back, you know, you can read scripture after scripture, and God does this over and over again. He is the greatest psychologist there is. He psychology is only about maybe 130 years old, like something like that. You know, Sigmund Freud was, I think he was born in like 1890 or something. So it's not this like real drawn out study. Like, you know, engineering's been around forever. But the same exact principle is that they're finding studies after studies. You know, all these universities are doing all these studies. Well, the same results are in the Bible, right? The same techniques, the same everything is already in the Bible. So he's, you know, God knows you and how your brain works better than anything. You know, we know more about deep outer space than we know about the brain. So if you really want to learn, you know, the scriptures are really, if you really take it from God's perspective, really how you're going to learn how to build this rapport. So this is, you know, part of your humility and you know, sacrificing yourself, right? Empathy-based motivation, you are really killing the self. That's all you're doing. You know, you are saying, I'm going to do the right thing regardless of what happens to me. And if you don't do that, it's not sustainable. Because first off, you're going to do great things and never get rewarded. Every kid does great things and nobody claps them on the back. You know, nobody can see it. You could be the greatest parent ever and you're not going to see every great thing your kid does. And then you're going to do terrible things and get away with it and not get these consequences. Right? And humans think funny. You know, if 99 people called you pretty and one person called you ugly, which one are you going to think about? Right? So if you got caught 99 times and you got away with it one time, which one are you going to think about when you got to make that decision again? You know, that's why this is so unsustainable to really focus on this gratification for yourself. It's just not going to work. So, you know, I guess kind of my last point, and this is an important point too, is being able to sustain. You know, I've grown up in church, and I'm sure a lot of you have experienced this, where people get saved 5 or 6 times, right?
Yeah.
And then people, they go into, you know, relapses and all this stuff. And there is a psychology behind that. If you're changing out of fear, it's not going to work, okay? If you're changing over guilt, it's not going to work. It's not something that, or even peer pressure, you know? It's not genuine change. Your heart hasn't been filled. And a lot of times, you know, you guys have been wonderful since we've come here. I've never been to such a welcoming church. You know, I couldn't ask for more. And I haven't experienced that here, but I have experienced other places where, you know, it's really like, you know, hell and brimstone, and, you know, but when you get to heaven, it's going to be awesome. And, you know, if you can follow Christ, let's say would you make that decision to follow Christ even if it took you to hell? You know, that's really what we're trying to focus on, you know. That end result is meaningless. It does not matter what happens to me. It absolutely does not. So, and that really goes back to that, just willing yourself. And that's the biggest struggle you'll face, is that I have to will myself to do these things. It's not a knowledge issue. It's not it's not you trying to figure out what's wrong or right. It's really just saying, can I kill off myself and not worry about how it's going to affect me? And sometimes it's hard, because sometimes it, you know, not every decision is that simplified. I try to simplify it for kids, like, if it helps someone, then it's a great decision. If it hurts someone, it's a bad decision. But it's a lot more complicated than that. You know, if it helps someone but hurts you, is that the right decision? And all that with a kid is very hard to explain. But, and I can't really take a five-year-old and say, hey, even if this makes you feel awful, keep doing it. You know, that's probably not going to work. But the older you get and the more spiritually you grow, you just have to focus on, I do not care what happens to me. You know, I have to make the right decision. You guys may already be doing all this stuff, and I think it's great if you are. Maybe you can help me some. You know, if you're like, hey, you know, maybe you should do this, and this. You know, I'll be honest with you, I mess up every 10 seconds. My wife would tell you every 5 seconds. you know, and so don't. And I'm not the end all be all in this. You know, there's a ton of research. There's a ton of information on how things, how to interact like this. And, you know, you would never think that, you know, when I was growing up, I always had this, like, stereotypical thought of psychology and psychologists and stuff. But really, you know, once I got into it, I started understanding that, hey, this is really applies to my own beliefs and following, you know. I was in church one time, and this shows you kind of how stereotypical this stuff is. This preacher got up and he said, anybody ever explain what psychology meant? I was like, oh, great. And I was in college during this, and he's like, ology means the study of. And he said, so it's the study of psychos. I was like, man, you couldn't like... So there is, you know, I definitely get that stereotypical stuff too, that people have preconceived notions. Like, you know, I am your, like, you know, my office is like your typical, like, I guess, shrink's office, you know. So it is, especially around here, mental health is seen as a weakness. Like, if you have depression, it's seen as a weakness around here. But, you know, my father hardly ever expresses emotions. It's one of those things that when you really dwell into it, people don't like talking about. You know, if they show any sign of, hey, I'm struggling with this or this or this, you know, it's almost like it takes from your masculinity, you know, or you're not a strong woman because of this, you know. And that's really not the case. As a human, you should be feeling all these different feelings. It's okay to get angry sometimes. It's okay to get depressed sometimes. It's part of being a human. And, but that's definitely not how it's seen around here. So, but I think, I'm pretty sure that's my last slide. But I do want to thank everybody here for just allowing me to talk about this stuff. I am very passionate about it. And I'm still I've been a therapist about 6 years. But I'm still very young in it. And you guys have a ton of experience. And if you ever want to talk about it or ask questions or give me pointers, I would definitely be welcome to it. My wife's a therapist too, actually, so our kid will probably end up crazy, but definitely pray for him. So, and don't worry, I don't diagnose people outside of office. The only person I've diagnosed here is Jonathan, but that's a whole nother message. All right. So, but I do appreciate you all allowing me to do this, and I will turn it over to Chad.